Welcome to History Here and Now. I'm Thomas, the Voice Insider podcast machine, and today is a great day to learn about history. The History Here and Now podcast is dedicated to bringing you great stories from the past, and here we talk about people, places, events, culture, and practically every other facet involved with history. Does it sound complicated? Well, history is just that, complicated, but it doesn't have to be. I'm here to help break things down and make history more fun and relatable. So let's get started. Now, before we segue into today's topic, I kind of have a question for everyone out there. And for those of you who have read the book, you would hopefully have an answer. So in the book Catch-22, Captain John Yuzarian was crazy. Or wasn't crazy. Was he? I mean, he kept flying combat missions that made him crazy, but he tried getting out of flying combat missions, so that's not being crazy. Well, putting aside the Catch-22, one can't doubt the fierce fighting over the skies of Europe and the Pacific in World War II. When you read about the survival odds of bomber crews and airplane pilots, the level of carnage and death they faced was unfathomable. Stories of airmen not knowing the names of their fellow crew members because they died so quickly, you know, that was commonplace. The Pacific Theater was the United States' first foray into the global conflict, and the longest. In 1942, the Japanese Empire stretched throughout the Western Pacific, conquering the Philippines, sections of Southeast Asia, parts of mainland China, and many islands throughout the South Pacific. With the success of the U.S. Navy at the Battle of Midway, Japanese expansion halted and the United States began working its way through the Pacific Ocean by hopping from one major island chain to the next. But it wasn't just about controlling the shipping lanes, controlling the airspace was just as crucial. And so in April 1943, as plans to retake New Guinea and the Solomon Islands formulated, the first United States Army Air Force unit arrived in the South Pacific, and they are the subject of today's episode, the 345th Bombardment Group, also known as the Air Apaches. Now, the Air Apaches are kind of a very unique group when you think of, you know, the typical units that served during World War II. They were one of the few active bomber commands that were on active duty in the South Pacific. We hear a lot about the bomber commands from like the 8th Air Force, you know, stationed over in Europe and their bombing raids over Germany. But the 345th sometimes doesn't get as much coverage as, you know, the other bomber groups do during this war. Now, originally, the 345th was slated for service in the European theater. The 5th Air Force and 345th was rerouted to the Pacific in order to conduct heavy bombing raids on Japanese-occupied islands. Now, bombers were a new element in aerial warfare. They were larger, more heavily armored, and could travel longer distances. The bomber of preference, the B-25 Mitchell, was the selected plane for the 345th. A medium-range bomber with 12 machine gun emplacements made it a deadly gunship. They carried payloads of 3,000 pounds of bombs, were ideal for hitting targets like ships and airfields, which, of course, is crucial for expansion in the Pacific Ocean. Now, the B-25s were the signature aircraft for the United States Army Air Force, as they were the same models used in the Doolittle raids on the Japanese islands back on April 18th of 1942. Now, generals pushed the envelope on maximizing the deadly use of bombers, and the 345th would lead the way in the entire Pacific theater. Now, some of the four main squadrons that comprised the 345th were, in fact, the 497th Bomb Squadron, the 498th, the 499th, the 500th, and also the 501st Bomb Squadrons. Now, New Guinea and the Bismarck Islands were the first stop for the 345th bombing campaign. Their actions, performing reconnaissance reconnaissance missions, dropping supplies, and attacking ships throughout the Bismarck Sea, arguably prevented a very serious threat to Australia. And between April 1943 and July 1944, the 345th relentlessly attacked the Japanese garrisons and ships running through the sea. This triple approach of high-level bombing, heavy machine gun strafing, and skip bombing, which skip bombing is similar to how sometimes you could skip stone across a pond. You would do the same thing with the mechanics of a bomb. You could actually go down at such a level that bouncing the bomb off the water would sometimes hit like a torpedo. These were all effective in breaking Japanese control and opening the way for the liberation of the Philippines. Now, we're going to set aside the campaign history for a moment. And like most U.S. Air Force units, the 345th was comprised of these multiple squadrons, as mentioned earlier. The 498th were the Falcons, the 499th, the Bats Out of Hell, the 500th as the Rough Riders, and 501st as the Bomb Squadron, known as the Black Panthers. Now, these four units were at the center of the entire group. From their formation in South Carolina in September of 1942, the men who served in these squads did so throughout the duration of the war. When able-bodied men between ages of 21 and 45 registered for the peacetime draft, known today as selective service, they only actually anticipated serving a minimum of 1 year. But when the United States declared war in Japan and Germany, though, draft terms extended through the conflict. Draftees could expect to serve for as long as it took to defeat the Axis powers. Dishonorable conduct, injury, and death were a ticket out of the service. Now, similar to what the United States faced in the First World War, the country's military lacked in size and armament in comparison to European nations. There were rapid upgrades in military industry and expanding draft requirements, and they even saved time by federalizing the National Guard, making up for lost time in 42 as the country mobilized for war. Now, with the construction of new medium and heavy range bombers, the air war would take on more importance than ever before. Approximately 4,000 men served with the 345th, and the training they endured was unlike what most servicemen faced in the 1940s. Now, while the physical training was grueling enough, technical and flight training on using these new bombers was a novel challenge. Crews worked closely as a team to make sure every part of the bomber functioned and was defended by faster enemy planes. Now, circling back to the 345th's ongoing war, they took to the skies again from July to November of 44, hitting targets in the southern Philippines. Now, the Japanese knew that the United States would reclaim the country. I heard in MacArthur's famous address in Australia, "I shall return." And the 345th made it a point to cut a path to Luzon and clear the way for the American recapture. Now, mission after mission, the 345th lost hundreds of crews and bombers as they were shot down by fighter planes or hit by enemy flak. And during the Battle of Leyte Gulf, there was even a kamikaze hit on a group of 345th personnel stationed on the ground before they could even get airborne. Now, by the beginning of 1945, the 345th, or Air Apaches, began bombing missions as far north as the Sea of Japan, hitting shipping communication lines down through China and Southeast Asia. Destroying targets were necessary for military planners, as operations were drawn up for the really long-anticipated invasion of the Japanese home islands, also known as Operation Downfall. But both the United States and Japanese knew that the cost in human lives would be astronomical. Intelligence analysts at the time estimated that casualty figures would easily reach into the millions as the Japanese military and civil defense organizations prepped for the invasion. But now by 1945, the 345th was positioned on Aishima in the Okinawa Island chain, ready to receive new orders. But all of that changed on August 6th and 9th when Hiroshima and Nagasaki were hit with the first atomic bombs. Emperor Hirohito announced the surrender 6 days later on August 15th, and now the 345th had a different set of orders to escort the Japanese emissaries for the formal surrender before General MacArthur. Three B-25s and fighter planes were ordered to escort the Japanese detachment to the Philippines, where they began discussing the terms of surrender and the Allied occupation of Japan. The escort was not without some hiccups, though. Hardline nationalists in the Japanese military wanted the escort shot down because tradition held that surrender was worse than death. These fears were assuaged as the 325th escort mission formed a bracket around the Japanese planes and chaperoned them safely to Manila. A surviving airman of the 345th remained stationed in Aishima until they received orders to rotate back to the United States on December 29, 1945. Now, a book publishing the 345th's wartime record called Warpath actually describes this final mission in really interesting detail. So, how would it feel to be one of those crews on one of those planes having to escort the only surrender delegation finally closing the end of this terrible theater of the war? So, quoting from this book, "Our mission on the 15th of August was half in the air when word came through that offensive operations had ceased. Two of our squadrons, the only bomber command units scheduled for the combat missions, landed, and at last we knew. During the last 15 days of the war, though, we knew full well that negotiations were underway and there was not much doubt about the outcome. We had flown 11 completed missions and had sent 29,600 tons of enemy shipping. August combat operations during that same 15 days had cost us 12 planes. We counted up the kills, found that the group had sunk some 260 enemy vessels, damaged 275 more. In 28 months overseas, they destroyed 107 planes in combat and flown more than 10,100 sorties. On August 19th, six of our planes loaded with the great and near great of the group searched three assigned areas in pairs for the plane loads of jet peace emissaries that had left Kyushu in the early morning. The 345th had been honored, and those on the ground were either at the strip with a camera or listening to the planes on the radio. Major McClure had to land on Moco Strip to show the Japanese the way in, much of the consternation the P-38s also escorting. They had performed their last mission. Now, awards were showered on the 345th Bomber Group throughout the war. They earned multiple presidential unit citations, citations from the Philippines, numerous air medals, flying crosses, and hundreds of Purple Hearts. They were one of the most decorated United States Army Air Forces units in the Pacific. And the reason I talked about them is that in an earlier podcast, my grandfather had served with one of the squadrons, the 499th Bats Out of Hell. So, now, the Air Apaches achieved a distinguished war record in the Pacific. They flew more missions than other flight squadrons and were a central component of the Japanese surrender. Now, when I reflect back on the war stories that I had heard probably secondhand from my grandfather, now I can't help but think that he and thousands of other airmen, what they went through, you know, they were heroes to many, and just like my grandfather is my hero to me. Now, this was, of course, a gross oversimplification of the story of the Air Apaches, and of course, and I could spend hours upon hours talking about every individual mission that they had accomplished. But since I'm limited by my podcasting abilities and, of course, restricted by technical requirements, what we need to know and understand is that this group of airmen, you know, while they weren't fighting on the ground against the Japanese themselves, they fought in the air war where, you know, while there may not be dead bodies on the ground, there was always the possibility that you could get on that plane and never come back, or you would be on the ground and see your buddies fly off, and they also would never come back again. And a quote again from the Warpath book, "This is our combat story. The 345th arrived in the Pacific in time to count cadence with its bombs and bullets with the great aerial march north from New Guinea, through the Philippines, and onto the very soil of the enemy. We lost both flyers and groundmen, many of them. We made our camps in some of the world's most rugged terrain. We bargained for eggs and smuggled lumber. We were the soft Americans on a warpath that had led to the Emperor's palace. Despite commitments that were often overambitious, the sheer force and power of our spirit and weapons had made a record of which we can be justly proud. And we are proud." And that is their story. History Here and Now is a website dedicated to the research and writing about different historical topics. If you liked this podcast, hit the like button, share it on social media, recommend it to your friends and family and colleagues. You can follow History Here and Now on Twitter and check back periodically for the next episode. Until then, good luck and thank you for listening.